We have talked before in this class about the importance of translations and having good translations of the scriptures. I was reading today a report that I got from some of the Christian websites that I'm a part of, and it was talking about efforts that are being made by the Communist Party in China to translate the Bible into Chinese. The original work on translation into the Chinese language, or at least Mandarin, was done back in 1918, and it wasn't a particularly good translation of the Bible. So the Chinese government does a couple of things. The first thing that they do is that they require that the only place that you can buy Bibles is the state-sanctioned churches. There are still underground supplies of Bibles, but they're tightly controlling the supply of Bibles. And they've worked on this new translation. They say that they're doing it in the interest of having an accurate translation. But this is what I found when I was reading this report about the Chinese translation. Now, understand, I have not seen it. I don't think it's available yet in broad publication, but there was a portion of it that was printed in a textbook that's used in colleges to teach professional ethics and law in China, in the university. And it's a quotation from the Gospel of John. So let me just read to you a little bit from the article, and you'll see how important having a good translation really is. Here's the story that they're concerned about in the book of John. And when I start reading, everybody's going to recognize the story that I'm reading. Early in the morning, Jesus came again into the temple. All the people came to him. He sat down and he taught them. The scribes and Pharisees brought to him a woman who was caught in adultery. When they had set her in the midst, they said to him, "Teacher, this woman was caught in adultery, in the very act. Now Moses in the law commanded us that such should be stoned. What do you say?" This they said, testing him, that they might have something of which to accuse him. Jesus stooped down and wrote on the ground with his finger as though he did not hear. So when they continued asking him, he raised himself up. He said to them, "He who is without sin among you, let him throw a stone at her first." Again, he stooped down and wrote on the ground. Then those who heard it, being convicted by their conscience, went out one by one, beginning with the oldest, even to the last. When Jesus was left alone and the woman standing in the midst, when Jesus had raised himself up and saw no one but the woman, he said to her, "Woman, where are those accusers of yours? Has no one condemned you?" She said, "No one, Lord." Jesus said to her, "Neither do I condemn you. Go and sin no more." The translation that's being done by the Communist Chinese Party is pretty much word for word up to the point at which Jesus is left alone with the woman. And then listen to the way that the Chinese translation now proceeds. Says this: when the crowd disappeared, Jesus stoned the sinner to death, saying, "I too am a sinner. But if the law could only be executed by men without blemish, then the law would be dead." Now it's an unwarranted translation, and we could talk for a long time about the problems that I have with that translation, the specifics of it, but you can't escape the fact that the Chinese translation says Jesus stoned the sinner to death. That's first. Second, he said, I too am a sinner. And then they changed the entire rest of the statement so that Jesus says, if the law could only be executed by men without blemish, the law would be dead. I say that not because it's really a part of our discussion tonight, it bears on it just a little bit, but just to reinforce the idea that you need to be careful about translations. And if we're working with anyone who is from mainland China, we need to be aware of what the Chinese government is doing with their translation of the scriptures. It's shocking. It's amazing. I mean, this is just it's a bold-faced lie what they're doing. Okay. Tonight we're going to talk about how to read the law. And I have to be honest with you. I'm one of those persons that gets to Leviticus and Numbers and the middle part of Deuteronomy, and I kind of go and I skip to the end of the chapter because I'm reading all of these statements about you do this and you do that. And I think there has to be a way for us to understand the law and get something out of it, but not get something out of it that it shouldn't be for us. So let's talk a little bit about the giving of the law. The law is really contained in, well, a lot of times we say it's contained in the Pentateuch. It's really not in the Pentateuch. It begins in Exodus, the 19th chapter at Mount Sinai, and it ends at the end of Numbers, or about halfway through Numbers. And then on the plains of Moab, as Moses is getting ready to die and pass on leadership before the children of Israel go into the land, he kind of reminds them of most of the things that were already said. So you get a restatement of it in Deuteronomy. Why do you have to have a law like this? Well, the thing that we have to remember is God is making a people for his name when they get to Mount Sinai. Remember what Israel's background has been up to this point. They've just been in slavery for 400 years. They've been tremendously influenced by Egyptian culture. In fact, that's the only thing that they've known for all this period of time. And they have to somehow become a community that can live together in the wilderness and then live together in the promised land. And they need direction on how to be God's people. So we talk about the relationship with God, and that encompasses a couple of things. They had to reject Egyptian culture and the gods that they served in Egypt. And then they had to learn to avoid being caught up in the gods of the Canaanites and caught up in Canaanite culture. So a lot of things that are said in the law are intended to accomplish those two things. Now, they also had to learn how to live with each other. Slaves live with each other in one way, but they're no longer slaves. So they have to learn how to live with each other. So you get the relationship with God, and you get the relationship that they're going to have with each other. And a small part of the law deals with what would happen when people from the broader population of the earth wanted to associate with them. So you get assimilation laws. So if a Canaanite wants to become a part of the nation of Israel, how were they supposed to go about doing that? That's what I call assimilation relationships. So when we think about law, you have to think about the ways that the word law is used in the Bible. Sometimes it's used in the plural sense. It's the laws. There were 630 something specific commandments that the Israelites were supposed to observe because they were loyal to God. And you get things like the statement in Exodus, the 18th chapter at verse 20. So you have specific commandments, and there are a lot of them in the Old Testament. Sometimes law is used in the singular. And it's unfortunate for us that both the singular and the plural are the same word in English, law and the law. So when it's used in the plural or in the singular sense, it refers to all of the laws that are collected into one place. Sometimes when you read the word law, it's talking about the book of the law. And in the Jewish mind, the book of the law was the Pentateuch, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. The commandments, sometimes it's used to refer to the whole Old Testament economy or the whole Old Testament system. So you have something like the law and the prophets. The commandments are almost exclusively in Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and then restated in Deuteronomy. But for the most part, the commandments are embedded in Israel's narrative. And we talked about narrative before, but the law, the commandments, the whole Old Testament economy is a part of Israel's story. Now, there are some laws, some commandments that predate even the formation of the children of Israel. So those are a different kind of law. I call those the moral law. It's the law that came before Israel even became a nation. The law that said, don't kill. Okay? That predated Israel. It was a law for everybody, everywhere. And then you had covenant law. And covenant law was only for Israel. And we'll talk a little bit more about what covenant means in just a minute. Sometimes you see the word law used to refer to the Pentateuch as it had been interpreted by the rabbis. Now, they didn't always interpret it the way it should have been interpreted, but Sometimes it is used to refer to the Pentateuch as it was interpreted by the rabbis. So what's that mean for us? I mean, I'm not a part of the nation of Israel. I'm a Gentile. I don't think anybody that worships at Coburg Road comes from a Jewish background. So there's really no sense in which what was given as law at Mount Sinai has any meaning for us in terms of expressing our loyalty to God. We have a different covenant. We have a different law, if you will. Although when we talk about law, we're usually talking about the law that was given at Sinai. So there are some, I think, important ideas when we think about covenants. Covenants is a really interesting word in the Old Testament. Covenant comes from a word that originally meant to fetter. And the oldest use of that word was to tie two things together. So covenant is an important word. Sometimes two things are tied together that are basically equals. Kim and I are tied together. We're basically equals. We have a covenant relationship. Sometimes the relationship is between unequals, like God having a relationship with man. Sometimes it's between nations and not just individuals. And we, instead of calling those covenants, we generally call them treaties or alliances. But the Old Testament law, what was given at Sinai, is basically a covenant. And a covenant is a binding contract between two parties. And both of the parties to the covenant have obligations that are laid out in the covenant. Covenants created a relationship. And they have a distinct format. Now, when you're talking about this format, you see it laid out very carefully in terms of treaties that existed between nations. And we're kind of familiar with that. The covenant format that we're going to talk about, some parts of it aren't mentioned when you talk about a covenant between two equal parties. They're just kind of understood. But the formal covenant format followed these basically six parts. First, you have the preamble. The preamble tells you who the parties of the covenant are. In the case of the law that was given at Sinai that we're talking about, if the parties to the covenant were God and the nation of Israel. And it's interesting when you think about whether the party to the covenant was an individual or whether the party to the covenant was the nation of Israel. For a long time, the Jews thought of God as being their ethnic God. He was part of their tribe. And that's not really the way the covenant is worked out with Israel. He's not a national God. He's a God who cares about the nation, makes a covenant with the nation. But it's a covenant that's based on something other than the fact that you're Jewish. The second part of a covenant the second part of this format is the prologue. And the prologue is the history of how the parties became connected to each other. So in terms of the giving of the law at Sinai, the prologue is, you were slaves in Egypt. I brought you out by my high and mighty hand, and now we have come to this place, and we're going to make a covenant. Then you have stipulation. That's the individual laws, 630, depends on how you count them. 600 plus individual laws. Next part of a covenant is you specify the witnesses to the covenant. And we don't think too much about witnesses, but you know, just having gone through the wedding with Nolan and Amelia and reading through the marriage license, the certificate that they're going to be given from the state, that marriage license specifies who the two witnesses are. And the function of the witnesses is twofold. First, to say, yes, you are the people who signed this contract. And the witnesses are also saying, we will enforce the contract. Now, in the case of a marriage license, it's they're willing to enforce the contract on behalf of the state. Most of the time, when we talk about Old Testament covenant, we're talking about the laws that were given at Sinai. The one who enforces the agreement is God. He's a party to the covenant, and he's also a witness to the covenant. Now, sometimes the witness to the covenant, or the enforcer, the one who holds you to the promises that you made in the covenant, is talked about being heaven and earth. It's like all of creation is going to hold you to the promises that you've made. And you see it used that way in Deuteronomy, the fourth chapter, verse 26. So you have the preamble, the prologue, then you have the laws, then you have the witnesses, the enforcers, and then you have sanctions. And sanctions includes blessings. So if you keep the law, God has promised he will do this for you. If you reject the covenant, then God tells the witnesses they have to enforce the covenant this way. So if you think about the book of Revelation as a covenant book, then the angels that come forth from the presence of God are the enforcers, and all that they're doing is enforcing the curses that were laid out in the covenant. And then you have a documentation clause. The documentation clause, generally speaking, provides for regular review of the covenant. You have to read it. You have to agree to it so that it won't be forgotten. And that's Deuteronomy, the 17th chapter, verses 18 and 19. So you have all of these parts in the old covenant, but, and this is really critical, the old covenant is not our covenant. See, we think back to the prologue. How did we come to know God? It's not by virtue of creation. It's not by virtue of the fact that we were brought out of Egyptian captivity. We get to know God in Christ. The fact that Jesus died, that's how we get to know God. So the prologue would argue that our covenant is very different than the covenant that they had in the Old Testament. the stipulations are not for us. The stipulations were for those people for whom the prologue would have been true. And there are differences in the stipulations. The stipulations changed because the prologue changed, but the principle of being loyal to the covenant, loyal to the promise that you made to God, remains unchanged. So we have a different covenant, but we still made a promise that we're going to keep our covenant. So this principle of loyalty to the covenant remains unchanged. And we can look at the examples of what happened to the Israelites when they rejected the covenant. And we can see that because they were held to their promise, we can expect that we will face sanctions if we don't keep our promise that we make to God. So that's why the writer of the book of Hebrews says, every transgression and disobedience received its reward in the old covenant. And then he goes on, he says, how shall we escape if we neglect so great a salvation? So this principle of loyalty to the covenant remains unchanged. So let's talk a little bit about the stipulations, the 600 and something commandments. And there are categories of commandments. The first thing that we can say is that there are civil laws. And this kind of pertains mostly to how Israel was going to get along, or how Israelites were going to get along with each other once they came into the land. So you have the civil laws, and the civil laws specified major and minor crimes that could have been committed. And if you committed the crime, you were tried, and the civil law specified what the penalty was going to be that was attached to the commission of the crime. That's something that we're absolutely familiar with. We know about civil laws. So you had major and minor crimes that you could be tried for, and it specified what the penalty was for the violation of the law. But again, remember, those stipulations changed. The fact that many of the stipulations kind of look similar doesn't mean that the stipulation didn't change. We'll talk about that in just a minute. It's kind of like the laws in Canada and the laws in the United States. In many cases, they look pretty similar, but Canadians would never be arrested in Canada for violating an American law, and they would never face the penalty that the American law specified when they were arrested and tried and they were convicted of the crime. So you have civil laws, and then you have a whole bunch of ritual laws, or I tend to call them ceremonial laws, and they relate to covenant worship. You have laws for the implements of worship. Remember, you had all of the things that were sanctified to God. You had all of the priest's responsibilities. You had the specifications of animals for sacrifice. Sometimes plants were sacrificed for one thing or another. And those are all ceremonial laws, ritual laws. We don't generally have a hard time with the notion that the ritual laws have changed. I don't know very many people in the United States that would argue that you needed to make animal sacrifice because animal sacrifice was a part of the old covenant. I do understand that there are some places where Jews still make animal sacrifices, and they're very closely constrained by by American law, but for the most part, I don't think very many people think that we ought to keep the ritual laws. We shouldn't be keeping the civil laws either, because those civil laws are a part of the covenant, just like the ritual laws were. And when they changed, they changed. Now, there are some stipulations that are explicitly stated in both covenants. Don't kill. That's a part of the Old Testament, covenant given at Sinai. It predated the Old Testament law given at Sinai, and it's part of our covenant as well. So if you think about it in terms of three covenants, what God gave to the people before Sinai, then you have the covenant that was given at Sinai, and then you have our covenant. This statement that you should not kill is a part of all three. So you have stipulations that are explicitly stated in both covenants. They tend to be centered around ethics. And the two biggest ethics statements that are in every covenant that God has ever made is, number one, love the Lord with all your heart, your soul, and your mind. And number two, love your neighbor. So that was a big part of the covenant before Sinai. It was a big part of the Sinai covenant. And it's a big part of our covenant. Now, because they've been repeated in both covenants, then we need to keep that stipulation. We need to abide by that stipulation. But Ted and I were discussing the notion of the Sabbath. Sabbath isn't part of our covenant. Sabbath was a part of the Sinai covenant, and they had to keep the Sabbath, but it's not a part of our covenant, so we don't have a Sabbath. That's a mistake to try to say that Sunday is our Sabbath. It isn't. Sunday is a different stipulation. It's a different commandment to us than the keeping of the Sabbath. Now, we could talk about that for a long time, but this is something that I think is important. When you read the law, you're reading all of these stipulations, you're reading all of these requirements, and all of those indicate something about God's character. Now, ideally, they were supposed to have learned about God's character when they read the law at Sinai, and they were supposed to take that character and make it their own. And we'll talk about that a little bit more in just a minute. But God never changes. So the same God that they served is the God that we serve. We have different rules, different law, but the covenant that was given at Sinai was still the word of God, and it still indicates something to us about God's character. I have often thought about what God said about the poor man in Israel. And it's pretty clear when you read the laws that were given to stipulate what the relationship was to be between the poor man and other people in Israel, you have to come away with that knowing that God cares about poor people. There's just no way to escape that. So you could not take a man's cloak and keep it overnight. It had to be returned to him. And so the Jews took that statement of the law, didn't use it to learn about God, and instead what they said was, you have to return the poor man's coat prior to sunrise. So you could keep it all night, but you had to give it back before sunrise. And in our country, sunrise is when the sun is 6 degrees above the horizon. Don't ask me how I know that, but I lived in Alaska, and sunset and sunrise times become really important when you live in Alaska, kind of like they do here. So they would wait. Right now, I think technically sunrise is about 7:10. They would wait until 7:09 and give the coat back, and they had not violated the rules that were specified in the Old Testament. Now, they had not learned about God, but they had not violated the law. So, what can we say about what the role of law was for Old Testament Israel? Why did God bother to give the law, and why do we have it so that we can read it? And I think the answer to that is that there are several reasons that the law was given. The first reason that the law was given is that it was supposed to lead them to the future Messiah. It was a schoolmaster to bring them to Christ. And we could talk about that a lot, but we've already talked about that quite a bit. Israel's problem wasn't that they couldn't keep the covenant. Israel's problem was they chose not to keep the covenant. You could keep the covenant. It wasn't a shortcoming in the covenant. The shortcoming was Israel and their refusal to keep the covenant. So how did Israel refuse? Well, you have to think about the law in two ways. You have apodictic law, and those are just general statements. And those general statements set a standard by which we're supposed to live, and it's laid out as examples. It's not intended to give you a specific exhaustive list. So you couldn't be specific in every possible case. I heard a story once that kind of illustrates this. Two little boys were talking about going outside of their parents' yard. And the first little boy was saying, you know, I can go to the edge of the driveway next door, but I can't go any farther than the edge of the driveway. And on the other side, I can go down to the driveway on the other side of my neighbor, but I can't go any farther than that. And the second little boy that was talking said, well, I can go anywhere I want to go, but I can't cross the street. So if you live on a city block, you know, you could go all the way around the block, but you could never cross the street. So that served to limit where you could go. And the third little boy said, I can go anywhere I want to. I just know better than to want to go some places. So I think the law was supposed to get us to the point where we would say, I can go anywhere I want to, but I just know better than to want to go some places, because God is not like that. So I can't specify every case, The law is limited in its wording. It gives us examples of what we're supposed to do and what we're not supposed to do. But it was extremely comprehensive in terms of the spirit of the law. So God says to the Israelites, don't reap the corners of your field, because you need to care for the poor people as I care for the poor people. So don't reap the corners of your field. He also said, if someone comes to you at night and says, give me bread, you should give him bread. You can't say to that person, wait a minute, I didn't reap the corners of my field. If you want bread, go out there and make your own bread. You give him the bread. It's a much more comprehensive statement than to just say, like the Pharisees did, oh, I gave you your cloak back before the sun came up in the morning, so I didn't keep it all night. I didn't do that. Now, the Jews did a fairly good job of keeping casuistic law, that's case-by-case law, but they kept the specifics of it. That was the Pharisaical approach. Casuistic law, it's case-by-case. It describes certain conditions that prevail in certain types of situations, and it only applies to people that are in that condition. If you're not in that condition, it doesn't apply to you. I don't know if you've ever read the tax code, but that thing is about 15 feet thick because we try to specify every possible case that could arise. And you still have courts that have to go through and say, wait a minute, you're not in that situation, so that law doesn't apply to you. I think what Israel should have learned is my situation is like that. And this is an obligation that's laid upon me, and that's laid upon a person who's in a specific situation. But I'm kind of like that. So that is laid upon me, even though I'm not in that situation. So they had trouble distinguishing between apodictic laws and casuistic laws, case-by-case law. So when we read, we have to understand what kind of law we're reading. And we have to make some conclusions about who it applied to. And then finally, I think we have to say that the Old Testament laws, the old Mosaic covenant laws, were a benefit to Israel. They were never intended to be a millstone around their neck. They were a benefit. They made it clear that if you sin, you incurred punishment. And we don't always think of that as being a benefit unless we're driving down the highway and some guy goes past us doing 95 miles an hour, and we wish that somebody would slow him down because he's a danger to everybody that's on the road. Transgression incurs punishment. The laws were also an example of God's mercy and grace to his people. They weren't necessarily the forgiveness of sin, making sin as if it never happened. But the old covenant was reconciliation to God's favor in spite of sin. And there's a big difference between the two. I would argue that ours is the forgiveness of sin because it makes sin as if it never happened. The old was the reconciliation in spite of sin. Sometimes the old laws, the Sinai covenant laws, stipulations, had a protective purpose. They weren't supposed to eat certain meat because if that meat is not prepared very carefully, it can be very dangerous. So you have the prohibition against pork, you have the prohibition against unclean animals. It would be a mistake to dismiss that law and say, that doesn't apply to us because we know how to cook the meat properly. That wasn't, that's not a respect for the covenant law. Their covenant was not given to us. Now, can I still learn something from it? Of course. But the physical protection that was a part of the old covenant isn't necessarily in our covenant. And they had a beyond a physically protective purpose, I think they also had a spiritually protective purpose because it kept them from observing some of the cult practices of the Canaanites. Stuart and Fee talk about the background of Canaanite cultic practices and fertility practices. They would boil the lamb in the mother's milk. And they talk about how that was a part of a fertility ritual. To be honest, I tried to find information about that, and I could not find it. That's not to say it doesn't exist, just that I couldn't find it in the time that I had to try to research that. And I tend to take their word for it, but as is always the case, I want to find the original document. I want to find the original source. I don't want to say that I know what that means because so-and-so said that that's what that means and I trust so-and-so. I would like to find the original documents, and if you're interested in looking at the cultic practices of the Canaanites and how the Old Testament prevented them from being caught up in those cult practices, that would be a wonderful study. I just don't have the time to do that right now. And then I want to do one other thing. And I want to think about reading the Old Covenant law in comparison to other ancient law codes. The one that I, frankly, am most familiar with is Hammurabi's Code. That's one that we're taught when we're in high school. There are other laws that were also codified, kind of similar to Hammurabi's Code. Israel's law at Sinai was ethically so superior to Hammurabi's code that this argument that Moses got his ideas from Hammurabi is just not, I don't see how it can be seriously entertained. Yes, murder is wrong under both, but everybody learned about murder from God. So we all get back to the same God. We all came from the same God. We didn't all get the same covenant at the same time, but we all came from the same God. So it's not surprising that Hammurabi's code says murder is wrong, and Moses said murder is wrong. But when you look more deeply at Hammurabi's code, you see that Moses wouldn't have copied what Hammurabi said, what was in his codified law. Israel's law treated women and slaves very differently unlike any other ancient codified law that we've ever found. In every case that I'm familiar with, women and servants were treated like property. Old Testament law treated women and servants as equals. And Israel's law, the Mount Sinai covenant law, was so far superior in another way. It also provided that, well, in the words of Ezekiel, the soul that sinneth, it shall die. That's not the case in most other codes. In most other codes, if a rich man committed murder, he could give up a slave and pay the penalty. That was not the case in Israel's law. The man that sinned, the man that was the transgressor, whether it's man or woman, the person who was the transgressor is the person who paid the penalty. You're not righteous because of what your father did, and you don't pay your father's penalty. So Israel's law at Sinai was far superior, in spite of what a lot of people say, to the laws that were given, or the laws that were codified in other ancient cultures besides just Israel. It's not for us. It tells us something about God's nature, but it's not for us. It tells us that if you violate the promises, if you reject the promises once you've made them, they will be met with, there will be sanctions that are imposed. It's not the same sanction as existed in the Old Testament, and it's not the same kind of violation. It's not, it's just a different covenant. But that principle of promise keeping always applies. So we read the law, we get to learn a lot from the law. We just have to be careful that we don't get something out of the old law and apply it to us when it's really not a part of our covenant. So when somebody says, don't murder, I don't listen to them unless they come to me with a statement from my covenant, not somebody else's covenant. Now, I listen to them because it says something about God, but I don't listen to them in the same way that I listen if they bring information from my covenant. So, thoughts or comments? Let me unmute everybody. Unmute everyone's microphone, I'm supposed to say. I'm not unmuting you. I'm unmuting your microphone.
I think the perfect add-on to what you talked about in the book was the summary do's and don'ts about the Old Testament law, which helps you to recognize the purpose it served and what you can get out of it, but what it means to us is not what it meant to them.
Good point. And I sometimes fall prey to the temptation to use an Old Testament statement because it's so blunt, because it's so forthright, and it's so easy to understand that I fall prey to that temptation to go back and use the Old Testament law. That's an abuse of what the law says. Now, I've spent a lot of time saying that the Old Testament law doesn't apply to you. I don't want anybody to ever get to the point where when you hold your Bible up and look at it on the ends of the pages, you know, when you get a new Bible, the pages are all still stuck together and you have to kind of just break them so that they're not stuck together. Well, I have been guilty of owning a Bible for many years and the pages in the Old Testament were still stuck together. That's not good. And if you look at my Bible that I carry for many, many years, the dirty part of the pages, the dirty part where you get thumbprints all over it and it, you know, it gets a little ragged, the dirty part starts at Matthew. I can always tell where Matthew is because that's where the dirty part starts. That's not the way that we ought to read the Bible. We should be as familiar with the Old Testament as we are with the New, because it helps us to understand some things just knowing what the limitations are.
I like especially in there where it says, don't forget to see that God's mercy is made equal to the severity of the standards. But it goes on to say, do remember that the essence of the law is repeated. Don't see the Old Testament law as complete. It is not technically comprehensive. And for our modern day Jews, that's important because people who claim to be Jews must understand that they are not following the Old Testament law. They can't. It wasn't all codified. There were things that were given to the Jews at those times that were not recorded for us to read. Many of the things that they did, how they sacrificed, the people who were allowed to sacrifice, the people who built the temple, the people who built the tabernacle, the singers, all those things, we know of them, we know about them, but we don't know what they were told, how they were to do certain things, how they were to actually keep God's law. We just know the codified parts that God has given us as an example for us to understand God's mind.
Good point. Good point. You know, we don't, when we think about Cain and Abel, you know, the question arises, well, how did they know what sacrifices they were supposed to make? God must have told them. He just didn't see fit to record it for us. And there were a lot of things that God said that are not written down. If you think about it, Moses got a lot more stuff up on the mountain than just the Ten Commandments.
There is one thing that is constant and pretty much from the beginning till now and forever are the moral laws. They stay the same, don't they? I mean, from the Bible standpoint.
The moral laws are repeated in every country.
Yeah, right.
Yes, but it's not that they stay the same. They're repeated.
I used the wrong word.
Yeah, so
the other thing that the Old Testament really teaches you that there is a penalty for sin. There's always a penalty for sin, whether you think it's right or not. And people tend to justify, well, that woman didn't deserve that because she didn't do such and such. But we don't want to think that God will punish us because he's a God of love. That comes up quite a bit. And so the Old Testament really points that out.
Yep.
And it goes through, of course, because it repeats again in the New Testament.
Yeah. Oh, you're absolutely correct. The goodness and the severity of God are both parts of the covenant. That they're part of that covenant, they're part of our covenant.
The other example, man is man and man sins, but God will forgive you. David is a good example, and others, of course, but God loved him. He and so he he didn't pay the penalty of death that he said would happen if such and such happened, that you should punish that person.
It was in the Old Testament, it was forgiveness in spite of sin. For us, it's sin goes away.
Mm-hmm.
Frankly, I like my system a lot better than the old system.
Me too. Well, there was mercy in the Old Testament. A lot of people say no, but there was mercy and
right.
kindness and forgiveness.
We got to remember that the sins of the Old Testament were not forgiven. They were just pushed back
forward
and back till Jesus came.
Yeah, it was reconciliation in spite of sin. The sin never went away in the Old Testament. For me, the sin goes away. I mean, I ought to be able to say, if my understanding of the New Testament is correct, I ought to be able to say and absolutely believe it, that the new man, the new Dean, has never told a lie. The old Dean did. The old Dean was telling lies pretty regularly, but the new Dean never has told a lie. That's an amazing statement. And it's I struggle with this. The Old Testament in some ways seems to me like a 12-step program. Hi, my name is Dean and I'm an alcoholic.
It's almost over.
Okay. I know that that's effective. I know that it has a purpose. But I think the New Testament is a very different system where I would never say, hi, my name is Dean and I'm a sinner. I was a sinner. And I do still sometimes sin. In fact, frequently. But every time I reproach God, he will take that away.
Mm-hmm.
It's gone.
Oh, that's...
It's just an amazing blessing that we have.
Dean?
Yes?
I just have a question. I've been hearing in a couple different spots, and I don't have it set in my head, but it's been said that God dictated to Moses the first 5 books of the law. In other words, God dictated every single word and the way it was to be recorded. Have you ever heard that before in tradition or anything? Or
well, I'm trying to think. In terms of inspiration, whoever wrote the first 5 books of the Old Testament was inspired by God. And I think it went beyond just simple inspiration of ideas. I think it extended to the choice of words. So I don't know that I would say God dictated it to Abraham. I would say that, or to Moses. I would say that Moses was inspired to write what he wrote.